Half an hour at 10 minutes to 11. We'll start promptly at 10 to 11, so thanks, guys. Yeah. Sorry it has to be so quick.
Sorry.
I just wanted to get that out. I wanted to, you know. What's that? What is? Oh, yes, the internet, right. The internet is working. Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. If the internet is not working?
Okay. Whoever, it was working 15 minutes until whoever the guilty party has returned on their computer, which is now trying to do the sharing.
So who turned on their computer in the last 15 minutes?
We don't know the name. Someone went to go get the MAC address.
Well, I'm sorry, we have a conference to run, so.
Oh, Kevin Marks is one.
I'm sharing my bit.
Well, and what's the chance that the person who's doing this understands what you just said?
We want the one for Harvard. I can give you the MAC address.
Doc knows the MAC address. You want to just get with Doc then, okay? Because we've got a conference.
We'll just put the MAC address.
Everybody who's not on the panel, please stand and see.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, and if Chris Lydon, anybody know where Chris is? All right. Look, sorry for the chaos. Let's.
Christopher Lydon.
Okay. All right, so the next subject that we're going to look at is weblogs and education. Moderator is Lance Noble, and I'll let Lance take it away, okay?
Thanks a lot, Dave. I think one of the things that interests me about the weblog world is the way that it's a series of partly interconnected spheres. And we just had the discussion about journalism and that intruded into politics. A lot of my reading, I find, tends to be some of the academic blogs, because I have some esoteric academic interests. And there's very little connection often between worlds, people that are reading about technology, people that are reading about economics, let's say people that are reading about political philosophy. There's very little connection. What we have here today with this panel, to some extent, is a rather eclectic mix. Education is a very broad term, and what we're going to try and discuss over the next hour and a half, however much time we have, is a whole variety of aspects of weblogs and education, from K-12 education to dealing with university undergraduates to serious scholarship. And weblogs. Now, that's a very tall order, but we have an interesting group of people to help us in that. And perhaps the way I'd like to begin is if I could ask each of the panel to introduce themselves by way of saying how they're using weblogs now, relevant to the session. So you'll get an idea of the spread we have. So Pat, we start with you, and we'll just run through, and so you'll get an idea of what people are doing here.
Do I need this? Can you hear me? I'm a high school librarian and a staff developer for the Bay Area Writing Project, which is the founding site of the National Writing Project. So I'm using them in about six ways. I use them as a librarian, I use them as a teacher, as a tech resource person, as a staff developer, as a semi-administrator, and then I use them with my students, parents, and the local community.
And when you say you use them, is that you're doing things and people need to read you, or you're encouraging the students, parents, et cetera, to do weblogs of their own and to write and develop their skills to do that?
So I'm a domain manager for those users of a domain of weblogs. Better?
Okay. ACMA.
I'm ACMA Adam. I teach New Testament Studies and Early Church History at Seabury Western Theological Seminary in Illinois. I also am a homeschooling parent. I'm also project director of an online site for theological education designed to take advantage of the specific qualities of the online environment apart from the impedimenta of things like grades, tuition, credits, having to be in the same place at the same time, and a personal blogger as well. Brian.
I'm Brian Witherson. I'm a tenured professor of philosophy at Brown University. I use blogs for two things. One is I have basically what's an old-fashioned writing notebook that happens to be online and people read and write, might be comments about. And I also keep a blog that just keeps track of what new philosophy has been published to the web within the last 24 hours since I've written about it. This is something I might come back to later, but it's been a sort of nice service that people have picked up on and found much more, getting much more connections between different philosophers.
My name is Kay Trammell, and I teach in the online journalism track at the University of Florida. Go Gators! Oh, there we go, the chomp back there. And I use blogs in multiple ways. Specifically, I'm a doctoral student doing my dissertation on a particular type of blog. So I'm very interested in blogs in that regard. And then as a teacher, I am implementing blogs into the curriculum specifically for my students to report through their blogs. So we have interesting discussions. Our bloggers, journalists, or our journalist bloggers in our class every Tuesday, but I won't get into that here. I've also been instrumental in bringing blogging to a variety of different courses across the curriculum at the University of Florida. One being for designers and artists, and another being for education students taking a technology and culture class. So I have a lot of different things to draw from in regards to blogging in the classroom.
Jenny.
My name is Jenny Levine, and I'm a librarian. I'm kind of a handout here because I don't work directly with blogging and education. But I work at the Suburban Library System in Burlington, Illinois, and so we don't work with the public. We work with our member libraries, who are all the libraries in Chicago, self-service. So what I'm trying to do is get them into blogging, so getting the libraries to use it, getting the school librarians to use it, especially with collaboration with the teachers and the students. And then I'm a major component of it on my blog, the Shinton Librarian.
To start, maybe I'm interested in exploring some of these, the things you're doing more fully. Pat, I mean, you're using weblogs for writing and for encouraging people to develop writing skills and abilities, as I understand it. Why is that? What do weblogs offer that other means didn't? Okay. What's new about it?
Actually, Brian Bell and I had this conversation yesterday, and we were talking about it in terms of pitching it to teachers, K-12 teachers, who generally have very, very full plates. They're not interested in doing anything that is not going to make their work better. Not easier, but better. And I've come up with a phrase for it. I just call it digital paper. I don't call it weblogs anymore because that kind of puts some people off. What you can do with weblogs is read, write, and research. And as a representative of the Bay Area Writing Project, I'm constantly, as a staff developer, telling people, I don't care what you teach, if it's PE or philosophy, you should be writing. So it's a real natural to be able to say, oh, we're moving from a paper classroom environment to a digital paper classroom environment. Does that answer?
So, I mean, you're taking advantage of what was referred to earlier as the web as a writer's medium.
And a reader's medium and a research medium. All of it made much more accessible. All three of those things made much more accessible by the ease of use that comes with weblog software, whatever it is that you use.
Is it the ease of use that matters, or is it more that does the openness of it matter? Is that dynamic important, that people are writing things that are visible for all to see?
A bigger notion to that is the whole notion of audience. And yes, of course, I mean, that's one of the fundamental problems with any teacher in a classroom giving an assignment or creating a project. If the teacher becomes the only audience for that project, well, who gives a crap, right? It's like, oh yeah, I wrote you an ASA last month, now I'm going to write you another ASA, and eventually the teacher gets burnt out from reading all of those ASAs anyway. So what happens with blogs in a really kind of organic way is other people outside of the classroom walls have the potential of paying attention to them. An example, along with writing, Part of weblogging is presenting your writing. In other words, the publishing aspect of traditional writing is now sort of embedded into blogging. So one of the things that kids love to do, I'm in high school now, so I'm talking 13 to 16-year-olds, they love to make their websites look good. Well, we've got a real good working relationship with Brian Bell down at KCSOS, so I'm able to instant message him during the day when I've got some of these theme makers, what Brian refers to as blog rats, in my office. Well, what was amazing was watching these students interact with him live when he was in the building the other day, and also through IM&Me, because what we refer to in the writing project as the writing process that you all know about if you're blogging. It means that you get an idea, you pre-write it, you brainstorm it, you draft it, you get some response to it, you revise it, you edit it, you publish it. Brian does the same thing with themes. When I'm going back and forth with him about what I want, there's this constant back and forth in the revision process that results in a very fine publication, a very good look to the theme. It was really an amazing moment to watch the 7 blog rats listen to Brian talk about the way he does his work, and then to say to them, that's how writers do their work. That's how people in the real world do their work. So,
I wanted to add to what Pat was saying. One of the peculiarities of my working environment at a seminary is that my students are almost all expecting to become clergy, and exactly the openness to which Pat points constitutes a problem for many of my students who live in dread that they'll be caught saying something their bishop didn't like. Colleagues and I who are working on this are having to devote extra energy to entice students, or indeed in some cases to compel students, to express themselves in public. And the leverage we've got is that they're all preparing to become public communicators. I mean, in preaching, in writing newsletter articles, they're going to need to practice public communication. But the thing they're afraid of is getting caught at it. It's an uphill battle to some extent on that basis.
I mean, this thing about getting caught, Brian, when I suggested you as a panel member, one of Dave's colleagues at Berkman, John Palfrey, said, is he tenured? And I said, no. And John sort of reeled back in horror and said, you know, he's writing a blog and he's not tenured. Isn't he worried that there's going to be some stuff out there that a tenure committee one day is going to say, you wrote this, you know, and it's going to be used against you? Is this a problem?
Perhaps not quite in the way you think. I mean, there's plenty of stuff I've written there which has just been lousy and just bad arguments and clearly faulty reasoning. And that's okay because, you know, I'll write something else the next day and it'll be better and people go, oh, okay, is there a kid in this? The kind of stuff that actually has led to some kind of worry is, when I started this, it was a really, really micro audience. 10 people a day been reading it. And I was really just, you know, writing notes to myself on what I thought, what I'd been reading. And if I'd read something that was lousy, I'd write down, this was really awful. How did this get out into the public sphere? And, you know, thanks to Google and archiving and the like, this kind of thing gets back to the person you wrote about eventually. I haven't got the tenure yet.
So you haven't yet seen. Hey, what's your experience with your students? Is the openness of the web to their eyes an advantage, or does it have a sort of inhibiting effect on what they're doing?
I think their perception is very different than mine. The challenge, and I think I blogged about this last week, the challenge is that students have always had very clear expectations about what they should write when they turn in a paper. So if you're going to write a term paper, you know that how you have to, you know, construct your argument, you know not to use certain words, you know to cite people for certain things. And so there's never any question about how a student is expected to behave. When you enter blogging or internet-based discussions, it gets difficult because now you're on their turf. And so they're very familiar with the internet and how to use it and how to communicate through it. And, you know, they want to be uncensored and free to say anything they want. But you put the constraints of a classroom environment over them. My students have to contribute to two blogs. First, they have a blog that they report through, and they have to do it twice a week between 200 and 350 words and submit their best blog post for me to be graded. And then they have to contribute to a class blog where we talk about trends in online journalism. And so when the way that they write in their personal, or I guess I should say professional blogs, when they're reporting on their beat, is so different, and they'll often say things that they would have never dreamed of turning in their reporting classes. You know, they'll make comments, and I think it's a fine line between a professor understanding how to communicate the expectations and for students to start to understand that, you know, that this still is a class project. You know, it's a fun one, but it's still a class project. So I think that I'd love to hear some more ideas between all of us as to how we can transcend that and really improve things.
So there's an issue of decorum in a way.
Yes.
I mean, is that more you're imposing that, or could it be that they're sort of finding a different voice by the media? I'm unsure what the problem is.
Right. That's an interesting question. I'm certainly imposing it because the way that we have the classroom set up, I'm the online editor, and so I'm telling my student journalists this is the type of content I expect from you. These are the rules that we go by in our online paper. But they certainly are finding a different voice, and I've tried to empower them as much as possible to use this as their little commentary column, where we care about basically in their blog posts is that they are talking about an issue and then they're commenting on it and providing their unique perspective, and so that's the whole point of their blog. So. You know, it's a fine line between what I expect and what they're giving.
But don't you think it'll be interesting to see as the kids Pat's working with, as they come up, they've had one set of rules, now they're coming to these other sets of rules, and like at the Roselle Public Library, they have a blog on Blogspot. The Roselle Public Library has a blog on Blogspot for 4th through 6th graders for book reviews.
Right. It's definitely an evolution process where we as teachers are learning the best ways to implement it into the curriculum. Do we give them lots of rules and lots of instruction about what blogs are, or do we just kind of turn them loose on Blogger and let them, you know, find it for themselves? It's a very hard question. I think it depends what the goal of the teacher is.
I think there are two issues that we're kind of grappling around. One is just legal, as school teachers and as university types and as librarians. For me, it's CIPA, COPA, Children's Internet Protection Act, and COPA is Children's Online Privacy Act or whatever it is. So you have to be really careful about IDing students and horrible things happening and bomb threats going out and that kind of stuff. What's interesting is, at least in my district, this is also new, that nobody's blown the whistle on some major gaffes that have happened, and I'm glad about that. But actually, one of the things I'd love to hear from the lawyer types who are here, it would be very helpful for the education community to get a clear understanding of what CIPA and COPA mean for us in K-12, and I don't know about the university thing, and libraries. If we can, the big thing here is you got to understand, school districts and their server admins are overworked. And if something bad happens, you know, if somebody says, fuck you, on a blog, it's very easy for the server admin to go to the superintendent and a group of parents to go to the superintendent, and suddenly that blog server is shut down. And there's no discussion about it, right? It's just like, CIPA COPA says that we got to do that. So what we need to do before that kind of stuff happens is we have to understand what CIPA and COPA really demands of us, and then go into those server administrators and parents and superintendents and say in advance, look, these are the concerns that SIPAHOPA raises. This is how we're going to deal with them, right? So that's the first thing, the legal thing. The second thing is just sort of like a digital paper management system. When students in a writing class write, their writing does not go up on the wall. It goes into a writing folder, and the writing folder is a private place. Sometimes in a writing folder, there can even be a private journal. That student leaving the classroom has a journal of his or her own at home in his or her bedroom. So there's writing going on that is not necessarily public. Blogs can be set up in the same way. So you can set up a community in the software I use, and lots of software, that says, okay, everybody in the class has access to this site. There are some members of the class who are editorial assistants. They get to promote stuff out a little bit further, and then within the school, there's the ability of pushing out even further. It's no different than a newspaper workflow, I don't think.
So, I mean, that's a solution to some of these issues about SIPAHOPA and things like that. Does it diminish the value by putting it behind a wall?
Great question. My sense is, I don't know how, it was a conversation a couple of years ago. I remember how this went. We used blogs for a summer writing camp in Marshall University in West Virginia. And the first year, we assigned teachers to the weblogs from all throughout the country. We had a little bit of money, so we paid them. They went into the weblogs, and they responded to the kids. Right? So the next summer, we didn't have that little bit of money. So there was not that many, there weren't that many teachers who were going to respond. And instead, we said to the kids, you're going to respond to each other. Well, the outrage was amazing. It's like, hey, nobody in North Dakota is reading my poetry anymore. And why aren't the California people telling me how good I am? And the response from the coordinator was, you know, writers earn an audience. They don't get given an audience. So there's a way in which limiting that pre-writing phase, that revision phase, it's not a bad thing, the fact that the audience isn't there right then and there. And I think, again, with the workflow, that you could imagine a way that you would take draft stuff, put it out there, see if it got responses, and if it did, then say to that student, well, here, we're going to give you a weblog. You're writing really good. We want you to represent the school. Go.
I think from an education standpoint, that publicness is one of the most important things that we have going for us. Pat talked about how there's just that two-person relationship between a student and a professor when you're writing a paper. I write this reaction paper, and I give it to my professor. I get an A. Okay, the semester goes on. Football season starts. I'm now writing this paper at 3 a.m. I'm drunk, and it's due in 2 hours. My paper is of less quality, right? And I'm allowing...
Well, it depends.
Yeah, that's a different session. And so the student is allowing himself to have that quality drop because he knows that the only person who's reading it is the professor. But if it's on a weblog, it becomes public. Anyone can read it. And the way that I pitch it to my students is everyone is reading it. Your potential employers, the people who are going to give you internships, your mother, you know, the chair of the department, the dean of the college, all of these people are reading your weblogs. And so it makes them think more about the work that they're producing because it's so public, and it also allows them to become an expert in their field and to get other people to recognize and get the people in North Dakota to read their poetry and to put them on their blog roll and to think that they have something important to say. You know, so that I think that some of the things you talked on are exactly why weblogging should be integrated in across the curriculum.
And just a real quick follow-on, and that localization that somebody on the journalism panel talked about, you could see how that would work for schools, right? In other words, you're not going to get North Dakota, but you may get the editorial page editor of your local advertiser rag.
And I would also add that someone brought up earlier about critical evaluation of the sources that you're reading. And this is excellent when a student blogs and they see you can post anything on the internet. I guess. My 8-year-old, because she read that she read some Chinese astrology page and she was calling her brother a pig. And I said, that was the sign. And I said, no, he's not really a pig, it's the sign. And she just wouldn't let it go. So I said, well, you know, anybody could post that. I, you know, he could go in and post that, you know, you're an elephant. And she said, no, he couldn't. And so I set up a blog for her, and then she got it. So it does help with that evaluation as well.
You know, I'm fascinated to explore, as explore this notion that the students are writing for the public, and that if we begin to sort of scale this up, and we think about this thing now a year or two hence, or certainly 5 years hence, now students across the country and maybe across the world are actually producing a whole lot of the content in a kind of open source way for the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's really extraordinary. And there was a quick story. There was a guy here that visited us last week, Ono Purbu from Indonesia. And this is a guy who was a university teacher in Indonesia, recognized that there was very little information technology material available in Indonesia. So he began to tell his students that he would give them an A if they wrote 5 papers that could be published about information technology on the quarter. And you know, a B if they did 4 and 3 and so forth. And what he discovered was that over the course of a term, his students could not only produce valuable stuff, but it was a huge change in their consciousness because they now became authors. So then he upped the ante, and the next thing was he said, okay, I want you to do a book in this semester. And these are sort of 100-page technical books. But they've now done, you know, scores of these things. And these students are now published authors, and he's got to deal with a publishing company that pays them something for them. And it's just a complete transformation. And so when I look at this, I think we may completely change the, you know, nature of the education in society.
Is it the panel's opinion that everybody ought to learn how to blog as a life skill, or is it more like singing, that not everybody should do it
at
all? Pat? Well, remember, I don't want to call them weblog. I want to call them digital paper. And I want everybody to know how to use digital paper, both as a reader, as a researcher, and as a writer. Now, what's amazing to me is I look 10 years in the future, and I tremble with the vision of what's going to happen to reading and writing. Right? In other words, it's really cool to do audio-video productions. And audio and video productions, well done, do a lot of what writing does. So, I don't know.
Okay, we're going to get there, but first there is a comment from Kay.
Yeah. Should it be a lifestyle, or should it be like singing? I think that what blogs offer, and it's been said many times, blogs offer a voice to every person who wants to have theirs heard. And it's, you know, with the democracy of the web, and anyone can have a voice. Little Kay Trammell from Kansas can have a voice and have her voice broadcast to all the BloggerCon. And so I think that what that offers people is the ability to understand how to have their voice heard and to promote their ideas and to critically think about what is happening in their lives. And that just makes everyone better. Now, what I'm concerned with in my class is that I want people to be able to do it professionally. Often people say, I don't care what you think, I just want to hear the news, or, you know, I just want to hear what the facts are. And so I want to be able to instill in my students the ability to use this new medium and this new way of reporting in a way that won't get them fired. So kind of both to that question.
Well, and if I could just hijack the panel for 1 second. Going along with that, you're not going to get this without learning information literacy. And to me, that's one of the biggest things, that one of the biggest boats we're missing here is tying together educational, weblogging, and librarians teaching the information literacy. How many of you are familiar with ProSearch and WorldCat?
Say it.
ProSearch and WorldCat. That's it. Every one of you in this room should know what that is. ProSearch is a series of databases.
When you ask a question, could you please stand up?
ProSearch is a series of databases that has more than 10 million full-text articles with images. WorldCat has 54 million items. It's the majority of items in the world's libraries, and you can interlibrary loan request them. When you talk about kids doing research and going out and finding links, finding things to support what they want to say with that voice, those are the kinds of databases they should be using in addition to things like Google. You don't just go to Google.
Right. And are these open databases, or are they subscription databases?
No, the libraries license them. And your library barcode number gets you into them. If we would get on board with Universal Library Service and everybody had a library card, then everybody would have access to these things. Certainly the students do.
Well, wait, it's not quite there yet, and that's a big issue that we have to deal with, I think, or raise on the panel, and that is this whole notion of everybody can have a voice. Yeah, everybody who's got a certain amount of money and a school district that has a reliable server admin and a reliable server infrastructure, right? And I'm telling you, urban school districts are not in that situation, and rural school districts are not in that situation, and libraries are increasingly not in that situation. So that's something that we got to talk about before this is over.
Okay, let me just take this question here and then there.
I wanted to get back to...
Who are you?
Hi, I'm Ian Zuckerman, Harvard University. I want to get back to Jim Moore's sort of optimistic vision for, you know, sort of students creating the future in reporting in their weblogs in class. One of the major obstacles we've seen in this at Harvard is a pretty aggressive privacy policy, which essentially requires us, if we're using blogs in the classroom, to make sure that they're only visible to other students. And there's a capability of opting in and opting out of it, but unfortunately, just for technical reasons, we've chosen in most cases to construct the blogs, including the class that Jim and I are both working on, in such a way that they're only accessible within Harvard. So I'm wondering if anyone can sort of comment on university privacy policies and whether this is something that we as a community need to go fairly aggressively at to ensure that these things are actually blogs rather than just internal classrooms.
Okay. Brian, I think in Crooked Timber, which is a blog that Brian writes on, this came up recently.
Yeah, there actually was a bit of a comment thread on just this question. What seemed to be a fairly broad consensus was that if you give students the option of using pseudonyms, then that'll just giving them the option covers most of the privacy angles you have. And you might think, well, isn't that going to lose the whole publicness aspect of it? But in practice, hardly any students do. The people who are doing this were reporting maybe one or two out of a class of 20 would do it. It's not perfect, but that's a pretty easy solution.
Okay. Question.
Hi. Doug Simpson, coming up from Hartford, Connecticut. I think it was Esther Dyson who a few years ago got Bill Gates' 10T for saying that with the ability for so many to publish on the net, this law of supply and demand will make copyrights irrelevant, if not unenforceable, because there'll always be some free supply of information or opinion or reporting competing with that for which people now pay. And I remember maybe 5 years ago, we were hearing exactly the same thing about web pages, that now everyone has a voice. Everybody can get a web page on GeoCity and everyone can talk, and what I think we all found is that there are so many people talking that there was no way to evaluate at first, is this person worth listening to, and we certainly can't listen to all of them. My question in the educational sphere is, are we going to need to prepare students for the fact that their voices are going to be so diluted by all the other voices simultaneously emerging from the cloud that they're going to have to deal with the fact of just being ignored simply because there isn't enough demand to meet the supply of all this budding, potentially expert writing. That's just a thought.
So does every student want to be a star? I gave the impression in what I first said that perhaps Seabury students are all quaking and technophobic and so on, and I realized right away that Jane and Tripp and a bunch of my students, Jeff, now I'm going to be in trouble with the ones I don't name, are non-existent. In fact, one of the lovely things at Seabury is that in a relatively small student body, we've almost spontaneously developed a very active community of bloggers who read one another's posts, who have friends from outside Seabury who read their friends' posts and then become friends with the other internal readers. I think that what we'll see is that people develop the readership, the audience, that actually is interested in what they say, so that if a student in one of Pat's classes wants to be Glenn Reynolds, well, that student is going to be disappointed. But what that student may find out is that she or he has readers that they never expected to have and has new friendships, alliances that arise from shared interests. And that's the beauty of the free flow of links and information on the web.
Well, you say that people are going to be disappointed. I mean, I actually think that people might be surprised, because it's interesting to me. I mean, in Brian's world, there was a undergraduate here at Harvard, graduated last year, Matthew Iglesias, who came from essentially nowhere and wrote an incredibly influential weblog in terms of issues about, you know, political philosophy, ideas, and things like that. And I suspect for most of his readers, because he became very followed in that world, they didn't realize he was just some, you know, spotty undergraduate. They thought he was an authority. And it gave him authority, and it came out of nowhere. And, you know, I think there can probably be lots of stories like this, you know, much
but
more along the lines you suggest.
He was an authority, right? In other words, there's this thing in China. We have Chinese teachers. The school that I teach in is tremendously a large 65% Chinese immigrant population, usually first language. And sometimes we get teachers who come from China, and they're absolutely amazed how badly behaved our Chinese immigrant students are. And we finally sussed this out. What it is in China, if you walk into the room and say, "Wo shi lao shi," I'm the teacher, you're the teacher. In the United States, if you walk into the room, you have to prove that you're the teacher, right? He proved that he was an expert. The problem for my students, the students that I've taught for the last 20 years, is not being disappointed about being ignored. Their problem is that they've been ignored and ignored and ignored. What weblogs or digital paper give them is a chance to be listened to.
Allie. Happen through blogs, because obviously there are many ways that education and educational ideas are being disseminated that aren't necessarily blogs. So let's look at that.
Of course, MIT's open courseware,
exactly.
it's not a blog, but it's a step towards dismantling the institutional segregation of learning. And that's to a great extent the problem, right? That learning is officially only happening between September and June in buildings with professionals standing up at the front of the room. It's also the impetus behind the grant that Trevor Bechtel and I are supervising at disseminary.org, that people who care about theological topics, religious topics, ought to have a place where they can interact with learned people on the subject, not just in a passive, "Ooh, tell me what to think" kind of way, but really wrestling with people in the way that people come to my weblog and wrestle with me, a place where that can happen. And we use weblogs, Lance, to do that. So there is that means. Part of it is putting philosophers, journalists, librarians out in the open, where people like Callie can grab their elbow and say, "What about this philosophical problem?" I know that Callie does this all the time. Her metaphysics just bugs her, and she wants Brian to tell her whether there really is a world out there. And people like Brian and David Weinberger are available to badger about these via weblogs, digital paper.
What you're talking about is also sort of changing expectations of students and of teachers, and also demands
and of scholarship.
And of scholarship. I think there's a question here, and then we'll come to you.
You are. I'm Philip Greenspan, and I live around the corner. write arbitrary length items. So in other words, in the commercial publishing world, you can only write really about a 5-page article per magazine, because most magazines can't sell enough ads to run anything longer. And if you have a 15-page idea and you want to get it out there through the commercial process, the only way to do it is to add 175 pages or something. So it turns into a thin little book. So basically, if you have something that naturally lends itself to 15 or 30 pages, until the web came along, there was really no place to park that. And what I think is interesting about the blogs, to me personally, is that it kind of is a natural medium for Nietzschean like aphorisms. If you have a 2 or 3 paragraph idea or 1 paragraph idea, it fits into the form. But for education, what I find with my students, and I think a lot of people who teach in colleges will agree with this, they have a hard time stringing 3 paragraphs together in a coherent form. The last thing they really need is a literary medium where, 3 paragraphs is considered the ideal length, because, they still haven't learned how to write a 5-page or a 10-page essay that anybody wants to read and is willing to stick with. So the question is, how do you use weblogs in education to build that skill, or maybe you just use some other mechanism and say, well, this is something totally different, but can you use that to help them write longer form articles as well, which is, as I said, what I see as the principal deficit.
That's a great question. Pat, you're helping people write?
There's a Ken Moffitt wrote a book in 1978 called, I'm blanking. It's a kind of a standard text for the writing movement that kind of grew out of stuff at Berkeley in 74. What's it called? Who knows it? Ken Moffitt, University of Toronto? I'll get it on my blog. The idea was to change a research paper into what he called an iSearch paper.
Ken McCrory,
thanks. Searching writing. Ken McCrory, searching writing. So this iSearch paper is an attempt to teach at the K-12 level, in some forms. He used it at the university level, expository writing. So I can show you how blogs are used to teach this, because we did it with 8th graders in a really tough school in San Francisco last year, and I have a stunning example of one student's piece on the Black Plague that she did for her 8th grade English class. So, the details of it, I don't know. I think what you're asking is, how do you teach writing? And I don't know. I teach it. But I don't know how you succeed at teaching it, except that sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't.
But the question could be reformulated. How do you use a blog software?
Yeah.
A blog genre?
So
teach writing longer.
Yeah. A great example of that is this iSearch project, and I'll link it on my site.
We have students post sermons, sermon manuscripts on their web blogs, and they get feedback from one another and from cranky professors who give them an awful time about every little detail of composition and rhetoric.
Hi, I'm Cy Adam. I'm a teenage schooler. I've been blogging for about a year and a half now. This is back in the summer too. But I really don't think that students should be discouraged by being told that what they blog basically won't be read. I think perspective should be held. Sure. I didn't expect anyone. I started my blog because I was going on a trip, and I want my family to be able to keep track of me without having to email them all the time. And I probably have one of the lowest accounts in the room.
Not anymore.
That's sideblog at burningbirds.net.
See, Dave, you're right. We're blogging right here. That was the blog thing. That was
a
blog link.
But over the past year and a half, I've talked to people. I just made connections, and now I get maybe 10 to 15 people a day, and I really don't feel bad about it, because relatively, think about all the pages that are getting hit all over the land, how many people are hitting Glenn Reynolds.
Then their hit count, every 5 seconds. Where I just had a student who emailed me before I left for Boston, and she said, Professor Trammell, I just got an email from a magazine in England, and they want to hire me to do some freelance work.
Wow.
Because they like her blog.
Wow.
And so, she, yay, you know, she's really excited because she's going to be a graduating senior. She's trying to get the attention of other journalists and trying to really market herself as writing a particular type of beat. And, you know, she is getting that attention and actually getting now paid to do it. So, you know, I completely agree with what blogging can do.
I hope she hasn't asked about English word rates yet.
Hey, I'm Joe Jones, and I run Bob Graham's web blog, and I'm probably one of the youngest people in this room just looking around. Maybe right ahead of time, that's about it. My question is, our generation has basically grown up with blog journals and GeoCities and all sorts of ways of becoming a celebrity without having any credibility whatsoever. And my question is, do you feel that the widespread use of blogs in education is going to make future generations more skeptical of the media and more skeptical of the information they see from all around?
Anybody want to take that on?
I think that what it's going to do is going to make us better consumers of news, because we don't just, you know, sit there passively and take in the news and say, oh, okay, that's what's happening around the world. We need to critically be thinking about what this means, and, you know, I think it empowers, it empowers people to stop listening to pundits and to become their own pundit and to really look at.
I would also add that in a couple of years, the level of discourse on the blogs will get kicked up with projects like OpenURL, and there's a database vendor right now who, you know, if you go and you search a research database, there's a link that says email this, there's a link that says print this. They're adding something that says link this, mm-hmm. so that from the outside world you could link into these databases. Now you have to have the access to get in. But as that spreads, this level of discourse will rise, and you'll get more scholarly linking, and you'll get these broader topics with deeper discussion, and that will help.
Hi, I'm Jeff Jarvis, Buzz Machine. Just a quick question, KU and anybody. Have you seen students push this? It's not just about learning how we do it now, we guys with, you know, white beards. Have you seen students push it to new and surprising ways? Journalism or writing or communication or anything? What surprised you? Give me some examples.
I have. Like I said, I talked to two other classes on campus, and one was a web project management class where they have, it's in the Digital Worlds Institute at the University of Florida, where basically they have architecture students, computer science students, designers, and all this wide array of students learning about the web and how to manage web projects. So their instructor wanted them to blog, so I came in and I did my little blogging spiel. And then at the end, this kid came up to me and he said, you know, I didn't realize it at the beginning. He's like, but I have a blog. Can I show you? So he showed me this blog, and it was really neat because it was a technical tool for designers or artists. So when you see somebody who does the type of art that you like, you want to know, well, how did you draw that? What was your process? And so, you know, they'll say, okay, well, I started with the head, and then I went down to the beard, and then the body, right? And everybody has a different process, and artists will try to emulate another person's to recreate that type of style. Well, he has created an online tool in his blog where people can draw real time. It will record your every movement, and then you upload it. And so then if you're interested and you like, you know, this drawing that someone did, you press it, and you can see the exact strokes that they made in the order that they made them. And you can control the speed and all of that on there as well. And so, but he did it in blogging form, where reverse chronological order, dated entries, make comments about it, all that. So I think that's probably the finest example I have of students who are pushing it to the next level.
I have one that involves the planet Jupiter. We have this blog thing happening in my library, and there's a group that's formed around it, 36 teaching assistants. I have to turn them away now. They're called the Slackers School Library Advisory Committee. So one day we're sitting in my office, and this new teacher comes in, and he says, this is outrageous. Our school is called Galileo. The Galileo orbiter is crashing into Jupiter next week, and we're not doing anything about it because we got an astronomy teacher on the record. So we have an astronomy. Right. So the next thing I know, I say, oh, yeah, we ought to have something. Let's have a crash and burn cafe. So one of the students, a kind of advanced blogger, says, oh, yeah, well, I'll do an invitation. So he goes out and he designs this invitation on the Slacker weblog, which is a private space you can't get to. And what it is the planet Jupiter, and it's got the orbiter in flames. Somebody gave me crap about that from the physics department. You know, they don't burn in space, right? Okay. and then there's a coffee cup, and it says, crash and burn with Galileo at Galileo at the Galileo Library Cafe, right? That goes on our little weblog. One of the kids prints it out. Somebody says, hey, why don't we get involved with it? The student teacher writes NASA, and the next thing we know, we have three TV stations and two newspapers in our library, and we're teleconferencing with NASA and JPL with a teleconferencing facility that I did not know existed in my building. Because one of the kids found out that it was locked in this room, and he knew that teacher really well, right? The point here, though, isn't about weblog. It's about digital paper, right? In other words, it's not weblog technology. It's what weblog technology begins. And now it's a monthly cafe. You're all invited to San Francisco. We have a view of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Is it webcast?
Not yet, but Brian's working on it. And
we'll
so
take
there.
Question here, then here, and then at the back. Okay, so that's
my name is Will Richardson, and I've been teaching with weblogs in my high school classes for about 2 years. And one of the connections that Pat's talking about that I think is really interesting that hasn't really been talked about is the collaborations that are available when you give your students weblogs. We've had book authors come in and work with our students in the weblog. I have professional journalists come in and mentor my students in their weblogs. And I just think that it's really interesting when you open up, you know, it's one thing to open up a student's writing to a larger audience, but it's also something else when you get a whole bunch of people who might be able to inform students about what they're writing about and learning about that you never had the opportunity to do before. I can have a journalist from Washington, D.C. in my classroom without him even being there. And I don't need a video conference or anything like that. I can do it just in the weblog, which is really interesting. The other point I just want to make, which goes along with what Jenny said, the big difference for me is the whole media literacy thing. I mean, it's just totally changing the way that I have to instruct my students how to take the information that they're reading on the internet and process it. And it kind of goes back to what Jay said before about every reader being a writer now, too. It's just amazing to me to watch my students go to different websites, go to different weblogs, and be able to see different opinions and get go through that process of trying to figure out what's real, what's not, what's truth, what isn't. And the way that we teach our kids to do that has got to change because they're just not able to do that yet. And the other thing, obviously, is we have to teach teachers as well. I mean, that's the biggest thing.
So over the last few years, school textbooks have been made very anodyne by criticized textbook committees to the point where they're almost not worth using. At the same time, we have this parallel moving going on where all these multiple voices are coming out from there. I was wondering if there's some potential crossover there where you can work from the myriad of voices on the web to generate textbooks that way.
I don't want Dave to get upset at me for promoting the project I'm working on. There's no money in it, for me anyway.
Your project. Go ahead.
Part of the plan at the disseminary, if we can pull it off, is to generate textbooks with choosable chapters. In my area, we teach a New Testament survey with a chapter on Matthew, a chapter on Mark. These are actually books of the New Testament for it's a good book. But the problem, of course, is that you get textbook A, and you like the way author A deals with two or three books, but can't stand the way she deals with the rest, and so on and so forth. There's no reason at all why you couldn't come to the disseminary and get Kay's chapter on Mark, and Brian's chapter on Luke, and Jenny's chapter on John and the Johannine epistles and so on, instead of choosing ACMA's chapter on the Johannine epistles because he's just dead wrong. This is an enterprise that we're working to try to make possible through the web and content management courtesy of blogging software.
And actually, e-reserves helps a lot with that. There are a lot of universities, not so much at the K-12 level, but in the universities, they can take parts of things and
okay. I promised the question at the back next, and then we'll get to Dan.
Hi, Brennan Alexander, RIT. I'm an RIT, my colleague, and I have to say that I'm
relates with one of the concepts that people employ with reaction papers, which is this idea of experiential learning, where you take what happens in your real life and then you apply it to what you're learning in the classroom. So I think that just furthers that concept.
Exactly. We'll get to the question.
This gathering is very U.S.-centric and notably so.
What's centric? I'm sorry.
U.S.
United States. Every year for the last few, I've gone to Hong Kong and taught at the University of Hong Kong in the fall and going back again. And since 1999, in fact, they've set up a beta of Manila. And starting in 99, I have the students actually do weblogs. And there was something very powerful about it for them, and some of them were working journalists, some were not. But the spreading of this to other cultures strikes me as incredibly important because of the lack of political and other kinds of freedom around the world. And one quick story, one of the students back then was working for the Chinese news service from Beijing, and she ended up quitting. And when she realized she could publish and was starting to get noticed, she ended up quitting and moving to Hong Kong where it was freer and doing some very interesting journalism that you have not been able to do before. So I'm just encouraging the teachers, get people, younger people going around the world.
One reason why it's U.S.-centric here is that's all who can get in. Some of you may know Hossein Darakhshan was supposed to come here. He's the spokesperson for a rather large group of Iranian bloggers, and unfortunately, they won't let him into the United States for security reasons, which is unfortunate. But there are, I've noticed, there's a huge amount of blogging all around the world. And I get these referrer IDs sometimes to pages that are all in Farsi, so I can't read them or something. But it's easy for us to miss that because we can't read it. And a really worthwhile project would be for people to set up some sort of an easy way to browse blogs in other languages with an interface to Google translations or something like that. And for tech-type people who would like to do that, a translingual newsreader seems to be something that's kind of within reach now and would be enormously useful.
Okay. Pat?
Pagan Finder works pretty good for Farsi, I found. We have
a librarian right there.
So everybody always goes to what's the other one?
Babelfish.
Babel. Get the pronunciation correct. So Fagan Finder is actually a little bit better. It has more languages. We have a small organization that grew out of the Bay Area Writing Project and connected up with Weblogger.com because we needed hosting, called the Educational Bloggers Network. And we have about 150 members, and they range from China, Iran, Iceland, the Netherlands, Adam Curry, of course. Is Adam here? Hey Adam. Peter Ford actually pioneered all of this with Adam's good graces when they founded schoolblogs.net, and he could probably tell you even more countries that are represented because they've got like thousands of members over there in Amsterdam. Sorry, you're not in Amsterdam, you're in Belgium now, right? Yeah, okay. What's happening along with this that really blew me away was the software that we use will remain nameless but needs to sustain or be able to support Chinese characters. And what we've done is talk to the programmer, Jake Sabin, and he has agreed to help us with three very advanced Chinese-speaking students who are completely bilingual in an advanced Mandarin class in my high school. They're going to be translating the docs, and Aaron Clerico is going to help us out with some bugs that may come up in Manila. But sorry, I said the name. So we're using Manila. The point here, though, is we are actually going to have students with an international background working on taking a useful tool and translating it for use in the country from the country where they originated. So yeah, it's happened.
Hi, I'm Diane Kettle. A lot of what I'm hearing is really exciting because one of the things we talk a lot about is how to get kids to do collaborative learning, how to work with each other, how to have each person further their thinking on and find much richer products when kids work together. Kids being anything from kindergarten kids all the way up to teachers. interns to graduate students. I'm actually about to learn right now myself. But one of the concerns that I have, and we have a lot in education, is something I think Pat referred to earlier, which is the fact that we have a lot of schools that, and a lot of people who have this access, and we have a lot of people who do not have this access. And we're talking about the wonderful thing, how this is going to revolutionize the world, basically, which we might be a little more skeptical about, but it's going to revolutionize the world for a very small group. If you look around this conference itself, you can see it here.
Yes.
The majority of people here are white males. There are a few of us who are women, and even fewer who are of other races. This is an issue, especially for urban schools, and I'm worried that we're creating a have and have not world of not just technology, but actual learning because of what this technology can do.
Libraries.
if a homeless blogger can have a blog.
Yeah, the homeless blogger goes to a public library and blogs.
Yeah, but I mean, urban libraries are very different from suburban libraries.
They are,
and
but they shouldn't be. That's my point. We need to fund them all equally and give them all the same.
Right, but in the current situation, they're very, very different, and I agree with her. I think we are...
Specifying user, checking if the system is running fine, things like that. And the other thing would be renamed like something like, I think we haven't made up our mind yet, something like page site administration or page document administration, something like that. Like a little bit like you have these steps of evolution. The first area would be the command line interface. Well, this would be this one where you can do everything. Like you can do everything, but you can also destroy everything. So the next area would be the site administration interface, where you can do quite a lot, but you can't do that much as on the command line. And then the next step would be the authoring area, where you actually just the only thing what you can do is here is you can go to a section, create a new article, then go into the article, edit it, and then